Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit and nonpartisan forum open to the public. To attend a Commonwealth Club event, check out our program listing at www.commonwealthclub.org. Now we join today's program of the Commonwealth Club.
Good evening, and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. My name is Bob Saldick. I am the chairman of the Commonwealth Club's Board of Governors, and I will serve as your chairman and your moderator for tonight. We also welcome our listeners on the radio, and we remind everyone that you can find us on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. And now it's my great pleasure to introduce to you our distinguished speaker, Dr. Francis Fukuyama. Francis Fukuyama is the Bernard Schwartz Professor of International Political Economy at the School of International Studies of Johns Hopkins University. He is also the chair of the editorial board of a new magazine, The American Interest. His 1992 book, The End of History and the Last Man, was a bestseller and widely translated. He has written extensively, and his latest book, which we will discuss tonight, is America at the Crossroads, Democracy, Power, and the Neoconservative Legacy, which has recently been published and is being very widely reviewed. Dr. Fukuyama, born in Chicago, attended Cornell, earned his PhD at Harvard, joined the RAND Corporation for several stints, was a member of the policy planning staff of the U.S. Department of State, specializing in the Middle East and later in European political military affairs. He was a member of the President's Council on Bioethics, and there's lots more. But without further ado, I am pleased to introduce to you Professor Francis Fukuyama.
Well, thank you very much. I'm really delighted to come back to the Commonwealth Club and come back to the Bay Area. My wife and I, many years ago, left Southern California for Washington because I was going to the State Department. And when it's cold in the winter, every winter she reminds me that I promised that we'd go back to California in a couple of years, and it's now been 17. So if any of you know of a good job here that I could do, please let me know, because I think she'd be quite happy about that. I'm going to speak about the first part of my talk is going to look backwards at the neoconservative legacy, which will be about how we got to where we are in American foreign policy in the first term of the Bush administration. And then I want to go a little bit to look forward to how we deal with the world in the wake of the Iraq War and the position that we find ourselves in. Obviously, for me, this has been a fairly personal subject, given that I had many friends, close friends, and colleagues in this administration and considered myself a neoconservative. And part of what I wanted to do in writing this book was to explain to people that this group of intellectuals was really much more diverse and much more complex than people realize, especially in Europe, but I think in many places in the United States, the term neocon is a kind of term of abuse. It means something like American fascist or American militarist. And I think that it's important to understand that that really did not have to be the case. Neoconservatism really started over 50 years ago. It was a group of really extraordinary intellectuals, people like Daniel Bell, Irving Howe, Irving Kristol, Daniel Patrick Moynihan, Nathan Glaser. All of these were children of first-generation immigrants to the United States, many of them Jewish, but some like Moynihan, Irish, who went to City College in New York because basically at that point elite institutions like Columbia and Harvard were not taking people from their social class. And so they saw the world very much as outsiders, and they all started out on the left. In fact, there's this famous story about the alcoves at City College, Alcove 1 and Alcove 2. One was Trotskyite and one was Stalinist, and they all had these interesting fights that people on the left tend to have. But it is important because they came to conservatism via the left, and I think that had certain important implications for the way they saw the world. They believed, I think, consistently that there was a universalism to things like human rights and to human equality or the equality of human dignity, and that remained, that idealistic strand remained an important thread throughout much of what they did subsequently, and I think is necessary to understand, in a way, the background to this war. They came to the right really as a result of the experience of socialism and the Soviet Union. The Soviet Union became a monstrosity of unintended consequences. It was pursuing, in their view, just aims, but it ended up with the gulag and with the terror. And the other experience that was very formative at this point was World War II, in which American military power was used very effectively to defeat Japan and Germany and to restore a democratic world, at least a half-democratic world, at the beginning of the Cold War. And so, in a sense, right from the beginning, there is this idea that very ambitious, although just ends, if pursued too ambitiously, can undermine the very goals that they were seeking. And this, in fact, was a theme that was present in the writing on domestic social policy that occurred from the 1960s, 70s, and 80s in the journal The Public Interest. This was a journal that was founded by Daniel Bell and Irving Kristol. William Kristol of the American of the Weekly Standard, it was his father. It was a very influential public policy journal. Dealt with issues like busing, immigration, welfare, crime, and the like. And I would say that if there is any overarching theme to the writing of this group of people, people like Glenn Lowry, James Q. Wilson, Daniel Patrick Moynihan, it was again that the ambitious attempts to achieve just social ends that were embodied by, let's say, Lyndon Johnson's Great Society programs defeated their own purposes simply by being too ambitious, that ambitious social engineering projects seldom work the way their designers hope they would. James Q. Wilson, the great political scientist, in his extensive writings on crime, said, "If you think that the deep root causes of crime are things like poverty and racism, you will never ameliorate the crime problem in the United States by trying to end poverty and racism. It simply, you know, that's beyond the capability of government or public policy." What he did do was something that I've always envied as a social scientist. He wrote an article that actually made people's lives better. He wrote a very, very famous article in 1982 in The Atlantic called Broken Windows, in which he said, if New York wants to solve its crime problem, you should get the graffiti off of the subway trains and restore a sense of social order. And in fact, New York City did this, and it was the beginning of, I think, the recovery, that city's recovery from the nightmare of the 1970s. Now, this is all important and puzzling for the following reason. This is a group of people that argued that you cannot solve an important social problem or achieve just ends by dealing with deep root causes, and yet the same group of people, as we got close to the Iraq War, argued first that the deep root cause of terrorism was the lack of democracy in the Middle East, and furthermore that the United States had the power, wisdom, ability, resources to effect a transformation not just of this small country, Iraq, of 24 million people, but of the broader Middle East as a whole. And this, to me, was one of the greatest, you know, contradictions, in a sense, of that earlier legacy, that it did not need to follow, that point did not need to follow. The reason I think that things turned out that way was that there really were two competing principles. There was the relatively skeptical attitude towards social engineering, but there is also this belief in the efficacy and the potential moral uses of American military power. Now, many people think that somehow these neoconservative ideas are like an alien spore that drifted in from outer space and they settled on the virgin soil of the United States and took over the brains of George W. Bush and Dick Cheney and so forth. And you can see why there's also a kind of accusation of a certain anti-Semitic, you know, character to this kind of accusation. And I think that it's important to realize that this is really not true. For example, I believe that the view that American military power can and has been used for good purposes like promoting democracy is something that most Americans actually believe. If you go back to our history, the revolution, the Civil War that ended slavery, World War II that freed Europe, and Asia, and then the Cold War that liberated Eastern Europe. In each of these cases, American military power, in fact, was used to create a more open, democratic world. And so this is something I think many Americans believe. But the power principle in the late 1990s, in the writings of people like Bill Kristol and Bob Kagan in the Weekly Standard, I think got transmuted into something more, and it was their argument that the United States being the most powerful country in the world, ought to exert a kind of benevolent hegemony over the rest of the world to fix various problems like terrorism, human rights abuses, rogue states, proliferation, and the like. Now, that was the contradiction. I think it led to three very specific errors of judgment. I mean, one had to do with the whole doctrine of preemption or preventive war. I'm not going to say very much about this because I think in light of the failure to find the weapons of mass destruction, it's pretty obvious that there are real problems in it. You know, if you launch a war in expectation of bad things happening several years down the road, you have to know what's going to happen. You have to be able to predict the future fairly accurately. And I think that our ability to do this is limited. And for that reason, it's a somewhat difficult doctrine. The second important misjudgment, I think, had to do with how the rest of the world would react to benevolent hegemony, to this exercise of American power. There is a lot of what is called American exceptionalism embedded in the way that the Bush administration behaved. Even to assert a doctrine, as is the case in our national security strategy document, that talks about preemption and the need to use preemptive force to head off terrorist threats, if you think about this, this is a terrible general principle of international politics. If Russia, China, France, India declared a similar kind of right of preventive war, basically, the State Department spokesman would be hopping up and you know, immediately say, well, this is really a bad idea. We allow ourselves this right, I think, because we believe that we are more benevolent than other countries. And in fact, you know, there was an argument. I mean, that argument was specifically, you know, put forward by Kagan and Kristol at one point. I mean, they said that American foreign policy is more moral than that of other countries, and therefore we ought to have this right where other countries would not. Again, I would, you know, say it sounds pretty funny in the wake of the global reaction to the Iraq War, but it is a tradition that goes back to the founding of the American Republic, this view that the American democracy was founded in virtue as opposed to cynical old Europe. And I think, obviously, that whole has not worked because people simply do not believe in either our benevolence or our competence. Now, the competence issue speaks to the third really big misjudgment, which had to do with nation building and the requirements for actually doing Iraq properly, that is to say, managing the post-conflict situation. That, in a way, is one of the most puzzling things to me because, especially for a group of people that believed in the difficulty of social engineering, to have been so poorly prepared to handle Iraq is, you know, a tremendously great, I mean, it's a contradiction and something that I think is difficult to understand. My own interpretation of what happened was a kind of psychological one that I cannot prove, but I believe is really has some bearing. I think that it had to do with the very peculiar way that the Cold War ended. If you wind the clock back to the year 1989, before the fall of the Berlin Wall, everybody, all of the international relations experts would have said, communism isn't going to collapse easily. It'll be violent. There'll be resistance, and it'll basically look like Iraq looks now. And yet this political miracle happened within 7-8 months. This entire edifice, totalitarian edifice, collapsed. And I think that, in a sense, there was a generalization from that to, you know, all totalitarian regimes, if given a little push, would fall back to the default position of liberal democracy and free market economics. Without a good sense of how difficult it is to actually create democratic institutions, to create market institutions, that's a process of very painful construction over time that many societies, particularly non-Western societies, do not come to easily. All right, so that's the past. I think that many of these ideas were embedded in a lot of the policies and the official doctrine of the Bush administration in its first 4 years. And the legacy of that, I think, is one that even the Bush administration itself has been, in a sense, running away from. Because if you look at the way they've been dealing with the nuclear issue in North Korea and Iran, it's been multilateral. It's emphasized diplomacy. There's not, you know, early threat to the resort to force. We'll have to see what happens down the road. But I believe that, you know, the Bush administration in itself, in a sense, has recognized the unviability of continuing on the road that they established in the first 4 years. The question is, what do we do going into the future? How do we reconnect with the world, and how do we deal with the real problem that exists of radical Islamism? Now, let me talk about that specific question at some length, because I think it is widely misunderstood, and it's become part of our national strategy, a certain interpretation of this, which I think is not right. I get a lot of emails from people saying, don't you understand that since September 11th, you know, we face this really huge problem, and that problem is the religion Islam, that if you go back to the Quran and the Hadith, that it mandates jihad and violence, and this is really what we are dealing with. It's a reassertion of this traditional religion, and it is really a kind of clash of civilizations, to coin a clever phrase. I believe that this interpretation of what is happening is actually completely wrong and misunderstands the nature of the threat. If you think of what a traditional Muslim society is, it is, first of all, one in which people's what it means to be religious, and Islam is a very legalistic religion, is to live by a certain set of very clearly specified social rules that are set by your family, by the mosque, by the local mullah, by the state. All of these social institutions tell you exactly who you are, and in a certain sense, there's no problem with identity. I mean, most Muslims don't have the problem of trying to understand who they are. That is not what we are facing in the kind of extremist doctrines that are being pushed by people like Osama bin Laden. If you look at the doctrines themselves, it's actually quite interesting because a lot of it, a lot of the specific terms and concepts used, civil society, the state, revolution, the aestheticization of violence, all of these things don't come out of traditional Islam. They come out of the extremist European politics of the 20th century, either the extreme right or the extreme left. Hassan al-Banna, who founded the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt in the 1920s, actually dressed his youth corps up in khaki shorts because he was imitating Mussolini's fascists. And so the doctrine itself, the modern doctrine, is not really, I mean, it's not related to a traditional form of Islam. It is a political ideology that uses religion but combines it with a lot of modern ideas. Now, the question is, right, this stuff is produced in Saudi Arabia, in Pakistan, in other parts of the Muslim world. Why do people respond to it? And here there's a, I think, quite brilliant analysis by the French Islamicist Olivier Waugh, who wrote a book a year or two ago called Globalized Islam, and he made the following argument. The problem that we are facing actually is not in traditional Muslim societies, because in those societies people really know who they are and what their social roles are. The problem is really because Muslims travel, they migrate, and they migrate to places like Western Europe. In this Muslim diaspora, they confront a modernity, and the terrorism and the extremism is actually a result of the confrontation that takes place with modern life. And that is why, and if you think about who have been terrorists in the last, since September 11th, Mohammed Atta, radicalized, he was trained as an engineer, radicalized in Hamburg, Mohammed Bouyeri, the second generation Dutch-speaking Dutch citizen who murdered the filmmaker Theo van Gogh, the July 7th bombers, all you know, Yorkshire accents, second-generation British citizens, the March 11th bombers in Madrid, even this fellow Zacharias Moussaoui that was just on trial in Alexandria, grew up in an orphanage where in France, all right? These were not people that were radicalized in a cave in Afghanistan. They were radicalized in democratic, modern Western Europe. And I think the reason that that happens is that there is a really big problem with identity in modern Europe. For the situation of a Muslim living in a modern European society, the first generation actually doesn't have that much problem because they've usually come from rural Morocco or Turkey, and they basically take the social customs and traditions from their home country with them, and that's what they live by. The real problem comes with the second and third generation children of these immigrants, because they do not integrate well, not nearly as well into European society as most immigrants integrate into American society. So it is extremely difficult for a Turk to get up even a third-generation Turk living in Germany that speaks nothing but German, it's very hard for that person to get up and say, I'm a German, because, in fact, up until the year 2000, the German citizenship laws would not allow such a person to be naturalized as a German. And so you find yourself really caught between two cultures. You do not have the modern culture of Europe, and you do not have, and in some sense you despise, the traditional culture of your parents. And under those circumstances, Osama bin Laden comes along and says, I'll tell you exactly who you are. You're a member of this global ummah that stretches from Morocco to Indonesia. It is a very pure form, an abstract form of the doctrine that is pervaded, you know, like extremist millenarian doctrines in the past. There's also, well, this, I think, contains both good news and bad news for us in a certain way. I mean, the good news is rather limited. The good news is that, in a sense, this is a familiar phenomenon, because I believe that modernity, modernization, has been producing this kind of alienation right from the beginning. There's a long literature about European fascism and how it had roots in the movement of European peasants from a small, tightly bonded society into Berlin or Hamburg or a big alienating city. And I think in earlier generations, people in the same situation would have been anarchists or Bolsheviks or fascists or members of the Bader-Meinhof gang. There's also this very interesting suggestion. This is the point that I get to insult all the Lutherans in the room, but Olivier Waugh makes a lot of people have said, well, the problem with Islam is it's never had the equivalent of a Protestant Reformation. It's never had a Martin Luther who would modify the doctrine, make it less fundamentalist and more compatible with modern life. And Olivier Waugh actually suggests that the Muslim Luther may actually be living among us, and his name actually may be Osama bin Laden, for the following reason: that, first of all, Luther, the historical Luther, was not a liberal. You know, he did not advocate tolerance and pluralism. He had a very different interpretation of Christian doctrine, the essence of which was to say, you know, the medieval Catholic Church understood Christianity as a set of social rules and practices, going to confession, the rosary, you know, buying indulgences and the like. And he said, no, that has nothing to do with religion. Religion is an internal matter between you and God. It is simply a matter of internal faith. It's an internalized religion. And this is what made possible, I think, the modern solution of the separation of church and state, because you can separate the two institutions. The state does not have to support religious practice. That is simply a matter between you and God. It is a matter for private individuals. And in some sense, that is what is happening in these Muslim populations in Europe. They do not live in a land of belief where the state supports their religiosity, and therefore they have to, you know, turn to a concept of what it means to be a Muslim that is more based on something like faith rather than works. Now, this has a lot of implications as we go forward for American foreign policy. The Bush administration has argued that it is the lack of democracy in the Middle East that produces terrorism, and we've now embedded the promotion of democracy in that part of the world as part of our strategy for fighting terrorism. If you read the new version of the National Security Strategy document that the White House issued about 6 weeks ago, in a sense, I mean, it's very strange. I mean, most strategy documents talk about, you know, tanks and aircraft carriers and things like this, but the center of this strategy really is the promotion of democracy based on this causal linkage between lack of democracy and terrorism. If I am correct about my interpretation of where the susceptibility to these ideas comes from, they've got it exactly backwards. That is to say, the alienation and the susceptibility to these radical doctrines is the result of modernization and, you know, access to democracy. All of these terrorists actually lived in modern democratic societies, and it was, you know, it wasn't that they didn't know what that was about. Mohammed Atta, you know, went to a lap dancing club a week before he flew that plane into the buildings in New York. And so what that suggests is that actually more modernization and more democracy in that part of the world is actually going to produce more terrorism, at least in the short run, rather than less. Now, I think that we need to have a serious conversation about exactly how democracy and the political side of our foreign policy is going to operate. We actually have two views before us that are both, in a certain sense, caricatures. I mean, on the one hand, you have the equivalent of the Big Bang, that we're going to make this big push for rapid democracy throughout this region, early elections, just see what happens, who shows up, who gets elected. And on the other hand, you have Henry Kissinger and his disciples. They are classical foreign policy realists that think that we basically ought to look to our narrow national interests, not worry about the internal nature of other countries, and if you can get stability through authoritarian allies, that's absolutely fine. My own view is actually a fairly complicated one. I think that in the long run, I actually agree with Condi Rice when she says that it is going to be very difficult to base stability on the authoritarian coercive suppression of all of these new social actors. And so I think in the long run, it is going to be necessary to permit a greater degree of political participation. And if you throw the dance floor open, who comes to the dance? A lot of times it is an Islamist. And so the trick is to use that opening to participation to produce a kind of evolution over time so that those actors are willing to play by the rules of democracy and not go for the whole pot. How you do that is extraordinarily complicated. It is going to vary from country to country. I think, for example, early elections in a place like Pakistan would be an absolute disaster because the handwriting is on the wall with regard to the power of the Islamists there. On the other hand, Turkey and Morocco are countries that have both permitted Islamist parties to contest for power in elections. And in fact, there is an Islamist party in power in Turkey right now, the Justice and Welfare Party, that is actually desperately trying to get into the European Union as we speak. So in some sense, we need a much more modulated and careful policy. And I think one of the sad things is that now we are living with the politics of backlash, that the policies of George Bush have become so toxic, both in the Middle East, in Europe, and in the United States, that there are a lot of people that will say, well, we'll do whatever he doesn't want to do. And so if he wants to promote democracy, then we don't want that. That, I think, would be a big mistake and a big tragedy. One final issue, I guess, has to do with how we relate to the world in terms of multilateralism and cooperation with other countries, because I think that this was one of the things that sent a very bad signal, our unwillingness to participate in a whole host of multilateral organizations like the International Criminal Court, the Kyoto Protocol, Landmine Convention, and so forth, in the first year of the Bush administration. I have a modest proposal. I actually think that the solution to international cooperation is not likely to be the United Nations for a number of reasons that I detail in greater length in the book. I think that the UN trying to be a global institution has got problems both with legitimacy. I mean, you see, China, Russia, Saudi Arabia now being part of this new human rights council that was just established. But they also have a tremendous problem with effectiveness, and all the proposals for Security Council reform are actually going to make that problem, that collective action problem, worse and not better. What I think we really need, and what is actually being born as we speak, is a world that I describe as multilateralism, in which you have many overlapping and competing international organizations. None of them are as ambitious or as global as the United Nations, but each one of them can deal with a certain aspect of international politics and international cooperation. And I believe that we are not anywhere close to a world that is populated by an adequate set of these institutions. The global economy has been spinning them out at a furious rate over the past 20 years, and we need to do this in a similar way for politics and for security. And this is what I constantly tell my students, when they go out into the world and think about their world as those that created the post-World War II world did, they've got to think about power, American power, which we're going to have and we're going to deploy, but that oftentimes that power is best used not as a blunt stick, but rather in the American ability to shape a world that is conducive not just to American national interests, but to the universal values of democracy and rights that I believe virtually all Americans believe in. So with that, I will stop talking. I guess we have a few questions, and thank you. Thank you very much.
Our thanks to Dr. Francis Fukuyama, professor of political economy at Johns Hopkins University and author of America at the Crossroads, Democracy, Power, and the Neoconservative Legacy, for his comments today. And indeed, we do have a lot of questions, so let's jump right in. First question says that your first question is this one. How do conservatives reconcile their skepticism of social engineering domestically with the belief in exporting American conceptions of liberty and democracy throughout the world?
Well, the answer is I don't know. I mean, that's the central point of my book, is that it was completely, I think, inconsistent for at least for the neoconservatives who argued in favor of this democratic transformation to think that they could do this in an area 8,000 miles away where we didn't understand the culture and the local, you know, habits and traditions. When, you know, as they say, in Anacostia, you know, in my hometown of Washington, D.C., we've not been able to end poverty or raise test scores or do all of these other good things that everybody would like to do. So I think that that is a central, you know, contradiction in their thinking.
We have a flock of questions about the United States' position with respect to all the other countries in the world, so let me summarize with this one. At what point is it impossible to regain the goodwill of countries opposed to U.S. foreign policy? Are we quite possibly at that point now?
Well, I don't think anything is ever impossible, and given how powerful and important the United States is in so many domains, I think that this is something, you know, this low point is something that's going to pass. But it's very important to disaggregate the different dimensions of anti-Americanism. There's a tremendous amount of anti-Americanism in the world, but it has different sources. Some of it is simply structural. The United States spends as much on its military as virtually the rest of the world combined. We can overturn regimes around the world without, you know, breaking into a sweat. Well, I guess we do get into a sweat on occasions. But, you know, in the case of Afghanistan, it was a pretty impressive display of American power. And they don't have a reciprocal ability to affect American policies, and that just generates a lot of opposition. And it was something that started in the Clinton years, the opposition to globalization on the part of even America's closest European allies really began at that point, when they thought that the United States and its multinational companies and, you know, control over the IMF and the World Bank was trying to foist on them an anti-statist social model that was going to upend their welfare states and social protections. And so this resentment really goes very deep. Some of the resentment, I think, is a very deep opposition to modernization itself. It's quite interesting that in the countries that are the most successful in modernizing, there's probably the least anti-Americanism, so that China and India particularly, is one of the most positive vis-a-vis the United States. And I think that's because a lot of Indians, you know, have great hopes that someday they will be able to live like Americans. And conversely, you know, the Europeans don't like us because they see their social model under threat from all of these American ideas and policies. And in the Middle East, they really haven't been very successful with modernization at all. And I think that accounts for some of it. But I do not want to let the Bush administration off the hook, because there's also, you know, a tremendous amount of anti-Americanism that was generated really by the policies of this administration. Some of them I've, you know, suggested, this implicit American exceptionalism, assertion of American exceptionalism. I think there was a very clumsy and kind of in-your-face, you know, use and demonstration of American power when I believe the United States should have been subtle and indirect. We can't help being powerful. That's just, you know, that's in the cards for us, and we can't help exercising that power, but I think it would be better not to rub other people's faces in that fact.
You attribute the genesis of neoconservatism to Wolfowitz, Bell, Glaser, and so forth, Crystal, but how did traditional right-wing Republicans like Cheney, Bolt, John Bolton, Rumsfeld, and the DOD entourage get into all this?
Well, that's a very interesting question. There is an assumption that somehow these people were, convinced by these outside neoconservatives, well, some in the administration and some outside. I'm not sure that that's true, and I think that's something that future historians will have to sort out when we have, you know, the Cheney, Rumsfeld, Bush memoirs, and people can actually look through the documents and so forth. I think that the accusation that the neocons had this Svengali-like influence is really wrong, because there are plenty of reasons for a guy like Dick Cheney to worry about Iraq. You know, he had been the defense secretary in 1991 when the UN weapons inspectors went into Iraq and found that Iraq was only 18 months away from a nuclear weapon at that point. And so I don't think he needed particularly to be convinced by, you know, his underlings that, this was a very that this was a very dangerous country. I do think, on the other hand, the president, you know, had much less experience, was probably more sway, you know, easy to sway. You know, one of the things we will have to see in the future is the extent to which his decision-making really was driven by this belief that he was protecting the United States from a nuclear weapon, you know, wielded by a terrorist coming from Saddam Hussein.
We have several questions about Israel, and let me summarize them with this one. With regard to the global war on terrorism, how would a true settlement of the Israeli-Palestinian situation affect that? What is your opinion?
All right. I think, a settlement to this dispute is really not in the cards anytime in the near future. So we're talking about a hypothetical situation that I unfortunately believe is quite a ways down the road. I think that the core of the terrorist problem will not be affected at all by this. Osama bin Laden plotted the coal bombings and the embassy bombings in Africa and, you know, the 93 attack against the World Trade Center. All of this was happening while the Oslo peace process was in high gear, and the United States was doing, you know, a lot to, you know, to try to create a Palestinian state. So I think that, you know, with the really hardcore people, it's really not going to make very much difference. I do think that, however, part of the broader problem is not the hardcore terrorists, but all of the other populations that they operate in, who could be pro-American, could be very anti-American, could be the source of recruits. On the other hand, could be, you know, helpful in the fight against these radical Islamists. And those people, I think, you know, oftentimes are swayed by the evidence that the United States gives that it at least takes the Palestinian issue seriously. And so I think it is a problem with the administration that, you know, when Karen Hughes goes around and tries to repackage our policy to make it, you know, more acceptable, she doesn't really address, you know, what is it that they actually want to hear, or what are they saying about what they don't like about the policy. And part of it is related to the Palestinians. So I think we would do better at the margins if we paid more attention to it. But I'm afraid with this Hamas election, you know, there really isn't going to be much progress in the near future.
You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. Our speaker today is Dr. Francis Fukuyama, professor of political economy at Johns Hopkins University and noted advocate for the conservative movement, who is discussing his criticism of that movement and of the war in Iraq. Let's stay with Iraq on that note. A lot of questions about it, and I guess this one would summarize it. What should be our approach now to the allegiances of Iraq's population to the Sunni, Shiite, Kurdism, and all their other primary needs? I guess people are asking for what should we do over there now?
Well, unfortunately, this is a, you know, an area where we really do not have terribly good options. I think the leave early option is not a good policy because. I think, as you've seen, there's this growing civil war. Our role, the role of our military, has really been changed enormously over the last 9 months, from fighting an insurgency to basically trying to contain a growing civil war. And I think if we leave too early, that civil war is simply going to expand draw in other countries, Iraq, Iran, Turkey, and other interested parties that may, you know, lead to a Sunni-Shiite split that will split every single country in the Persian Gulf, and that is really not that's not a good situation. Now, the real political choices that we face, I guess, are how long we stick with trying to create a centralized Iraqi state. That's been our policy, with an army and a police. Or do we, as Senator Biden recently suggested, in a sense, throw in the towel and make concessions to reality that there are really three states, Kurdish, Sunni, and Shiite, that are developing in Iraq, and come up with a very, very loose federation that would recognize that reality? Now, again, this is not a great, we may be forced to accept something like this. It's not a great outcome because it really requires a lot of ethnic cleansing. Now, the problem with that kind of solution is that you have all of these populations, including in the capital city of Baghdad, that are cheek by jowl. They're all mixed in neighborhoods. Now, a lot of them have been fleeing. This happened with India and Pakistan in 1947 and in Turkey and Greece and in the Balkans in the 1990s. And unfortunately, a lot of stability has rested on ethnic cleansing. I mean, the creation of homogeneous, you know, geographical areas that only have one sectarian or ethnic group. But if we were to go for this in Iraq, you know, people shouldn't have any illusions that this is going to be a pretty bloody, getting there is going to be pretty bloody. So I think that's the major choice, and I think that, you know, things are probably heading in that direction. And since we've signaled that we are going to be getting out sooner rather than later, our leverage has really, you know, decreased quite dramatically. The one question that I think the president or Secretary Rumsfeld, and Rumsfeld was asked this on a couple of occasions just last week, what is our plan for getting rid of these sectarian militias? I mean, that's really the thing that is going to undermine a centralized Iraqi state. And there's basically no answer to that, because they cannot be voluntarily persuaded to lay down their arms as long as they are so insecure. They cannot be forcibly disarmed, because who would have to do it? That's us, and we are simply not going to play that role. And therefore, I think those militias are going to remain, and a new Iraqi order is basically going to be based on, you know, their continuance. That's a fact. It's not desirable, but I think that's reality.
Enough of the easy questions. A lot of questions here about Iran, and I guess they boil down to how would you answer the letter from the president of Iran, and what advice do you have for the president of the United States with respect to Iran at this point?
Well, Iran, in my view, is a largely unsolvable problem because we've always had basically three alternatives. We could try to use military force to, you know, as in the case of the Iraqi program, to try to stop their nuclear development. I think most of those scenarios, if you think about them, just don't make much sense. We're not going to occupy the country and produce a coercive regime change. A bombing campaign, I think, is very iffy, given the high quality of our intelligence about the facilities in Iraq. I think that, you know, you'd be very foolhardy to think that you knew where these things were in Iran. And then politically, I think it would be a disaster. It would drive a lot of the nationalists, right, anti-regime nationalists, into the arms of the regime. So I just don't see a positive set of options there. The sanctions route that we are pursuing, or diplomacy, you know, I think we have to pursue. But I actually am fairly pessimistic that we will get sanctions. I don't think the Russians and the Chinese will agree. I think even if they do agree, I don't think the Iranians are going to be deterred by that. Now, the letter that President Ahmadinejad sent, you know, suggests that there is some possibility that if you get out of the framework of this European negotiation and go into a direct bilateral a set of negotiations, that, you know, that might yield something. That's possible. I actually don't think that the Bush administration would actually rule that out down the road, because I really don't think they're eager to launch a third war in this term. But I think the ground for that has not been adequately prepared yet. But I do think that it is a possibility. I guess one final thought on Iran. we don't know how dangerous, and I mean, we, you know, if all, well, I'm sorry, I was saying that there are three alternatives. The third alternative is regime change by means other than military, meaning a democratic revolution in Iran. I think our ability to bring that about by giving aid and money and support to dissident groups right now is very, very limited because, again, we've become so toxic and dangerous for those, you know, potential allies of ours in that country. So I think all three of those routes are blocked. Now, given that they're blocked, the question is, you know, what's that world going to be like if they actually get a nuclear weapon? And that, I think, is something we're going to have to think very much about, I mean, how to cope with and deal with it. It is, you know, I do not want to enter this world. I really hope to God that one of these alternatives, you know, that they are stopped in one way or the other. But it is at least worth thinking through whether Iran will not find that nuclear weapons are about as useful as the Soviet Union and the United States and China found nuclear weapons in the Cold War. That is to say, you can use it to deter attacks on you, but you cannot use it very much for compelling other people to do things that they don't want to do. There is, you know, of course, the scenario that I think a lot of people in the region are rightly worried about. You know, what if they, in effect, carry through on these millenarian, you know, fantasies of Ahmadinejad and use it against Israel or some such thing? And that, you know, I think it's quite legitimate to worry about that. I also, however, have this sense that while individuals can become suicide bombers, it's pretty difficult for a whole society to, in effect, become a suicide bomber. And so the real danger is really not that. It is that it's going to lead to more proliferation. Egypt, Saudi Arabia, you know, other countries in the region will see that, you know, they need this kind of deterrent as well. And in a more proliferated world region like that, given the violence and the, you know, the conflicts, I think that's, you know, that's not a, you know, that's not a very stable or hopeful world.
We have a whole group of questions about oil, best summarized with this simple question. Isn't it all about the oil, parentheses, with democracy if convenient?
Well, look, there's a level on which that's, you know, the answer to that is so obviously yes that it's not even worth talking about. But it means, you know, but that depends on what you mean by it's all about the oil. There is one brand of conspiracy theory that says that this was all the oil industry that wanted access through the Bush family and Cheney, you know, being all oil men, and that's the real motive, and all this other stuff about weapons of mass destruction and so forth was just a smokescreen. And certainly there are a lot of Iraqis who think that this is why they were invaded. Now, if by that you mean that the administration was motivated by an economic interest in having special access to Iraq's oil, I think that is total nonsense because, you know, what did the oil industry want before the war? They wanted sanctions lifted. They don't care who they buy from. They can buy from Iran. They can buy from Saddam Hussein. You know, they buy from lots of other authoritarian regimes, and so they wanted sanctions lifted. They did not need a war to get access to Iraqi oil. If you say, on the other hand, that, yes, oil was the issue for strategic reasons, that it's a huge, important resource, we're dependent on it, you don't want that stream of revenues going to countries that will invade their neighbors, build nuclear weapons, do all this other stuff, yes, we were obviously concerned about it. I actually don't talk about that much in my book because that strategic rationale is so obvious, you know, reason why we're involved in the Middle East that it doesn't even it's not even worth repeating in a certain way, but you know the particular combination in that question that the weapons of mass destruction and you know democracy and these other motives that were explicitly stated were just an excuse for somehow getting to the resources I think is not right.
What about the democracy part on the question? We seem to be encouraging democracies and elections all over the Middle East. They seem to be electing people that we don't like.
Right. You know, that has always been the reason that we've not done this sort of thing in the past, is that in this part of the world you get, Islamist groups that actually, you know, in some respects they are democratic, but they're just not liberal. I mean, they're not tolerant, and they don't accept, you know, a pluralist framework for politics. And I think, therefore, this high-profile support for democracy in the region inevitably will involve the administration in a lot of, you know, what looks like a lot of hypocrisy. I mean, Mr. Aliyev from Azerbaijan was just a guest in the White House who doesn't have a really great record in his, as a Democrat or supporter of human rights, and yet he was welcome because, you know, there's a pipeline going through his country. However, this has always been the case with these kinds of idealistic dimensions in American foreign policy. It's also not the case that it's purely cynical and it's purely meaningless. Of course, we have interests. We have national interests. And, of course, those national interests sometimes force us to do things that are not in accord with our ideals. We would be crazy to act simply on idealistic grounds at every turn. The question is, can something good come from the United States broadly supporting a sensible pathway to democracy in the Middle East? And as I tried to explain, I believe that that's absolutely the case. Just take something like the Arab-Israeli or the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. The old theory under which we were going to settle this was we were going to rely on this group Fatah, which was corrupt and widely regarded as illegitimate by many Palestinians. Somehow this organization was going to get its act together. It was going to clamp down on Hamas and all of these militias, and it was going to sign a peace treaty with Israel and live happily thereafter. And I think that that was just a fantasy, because I think that, you know, its lack of democratic legitimacy fatally undermined its ability to come to an agreement with Israel. Now, Hamas does not want an agreement with Israel, but a more legitimate Palestinian government down the road that is more genuinely democratically reflective of a Palestinian population that does want to live in a two-state world, I think is really the only hope for actually getting a peace agreement. So democracy actually is pretty important for achieving some of our aims. It's just that we cannot get there in a big hurry.
You have not factored in what is happening to the world economies, as described in The World is Flat by Tom Friedman. Would you let us give us some of your thoughts on that whole issue of the huge changes, globalization and so forth, in the world economies?
Well, I mean, if you want an optimistic take on the world, just turn your head, 90 degrees from the Middle East and look, further to the east, to India and China, because there, I think, the kind of world that most Americans imagined we were creating, an open, free trade a world in which, national borders tended to make less and less difference in the world, is and where prosperity would be spread more broadly, I think is, in fact, taking shape. And, in fact, it's taking shape in the number one and number two most populous countries in the world. So that's actually a pretty good record. And therefore, the global economy's record on things like poverty alleviation and actually bringing people out of, desperate poverty is pretty good. Now, this is another book and another lecture about the problems associated with that. I just think that anyone that thinks that India and China have this now clear shot to being number one themselves just, haven't watched recent history, because the politics of that is extraordinarily difficult to negotiate.
Well, we eagerly await that book.
Well, Friedman's written it already, so.
You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. Our speaker today is Dr. Francis Fukuyama, professor of political economy at Johns Hopkins University. The Project for a New American Century, PNAC, would you say something about that, what its goals are, what its objectives are?
Well, this organization, I think, for most of its existence, was Bill Kristol in a fax machine. And, quite literally. I mean, he, in the late 1990s, I think, believed that the Republican Party, this was in the days of Monica Lewinsky and the stock market bubble and so forth, believed that the Republican Party could not win if it simply contested on these domestic issues, and that the United States needed, or that the U.S. needed to change its focus to international politics. And so he began using this as a vehicle to argue for a much more forward-leaning American foreign policy, bigger defense budget, more intervention. He actually offended quite a lot of conservative Republicans because he actually supported the Clinton administration in intervening in the Balkans in the late 1990s. And you know, one of the action items on his agenda was regime change in Iraq. Now, the question, you know, people have this conspiracy, you know, theory idea that somehow it was this little group, you know, this fax machine that actually somehow got into the heads of the Bush administration and changed everything. And again, I just think that's, you know, that's not the way things work actually in Washington, that you had a lot of other very powerful players that had quite independent reasons for wanting to, you know, carry out the Iraq policy that they did.
There's a lot of questions, and you've touched on this already, but if you could just go back and answer this. Are we in the West under attack from radical Islam, Fatah, and Jihad? And another one, how would you suggest the United States deal going forward with Egypt, the home of the Muslim Brotherhood, and Saudi Arabia, the home of Wahhabism?
Well, yes, we're obviously under attack by radical Islamism. That's pretty clear. The real question is, how does that relate to the religion Islam? And as I've been trying to explain, you know, there's a relationship there, but they're absolutely not the same thing, that this is a political ideology that uses religion for political purposes to mobilize. And as I said, it's a reaction to modernity as much as it is something that comes out of a religious source. And so the problem that we face is really how to isolate the people that are adherents of this extremely violent and dangerous doctrine from, you know, this great mass of Muslims around the world who, you know, don't necessarily believe in it. And that's a very difficult and, I think, ultimately a political struggle. Egypt and Saudi Arabia, I don't have any particular recommendations. I think that pushing for quick democracy and two quick elections in either place is probably not. There's been an important change in Egypt and much more openness in, you know, in discussion, and that I think is a good thing. But I think that, you know, that's going to also be a very slow process of development.
You have called America at the Crossroads your most personal book to date. Why is that?
Well, the reasons for that just are my own personal history. And I worked for Paul Wolfowitz, the former Deputy Secretary of Defense, on a couple of occasions. I've known Bill Kristol ever since I was a graduate student. I was associated with Albert Wallstetter, who was a teacher of Richard Perle and Wolfowitz and Zalmay Khalilzad. I was also a student of Alan Bloom, who is a Straussian, you know, political theorist that is associated with neoconservatism. So in my background, my fingerprints are on a lot of these objects.
What do they think of your new book?
You'll have to invite them here to the Commonwealth Club and ask them directly, because I can't speak for them.
We certainly will. We can't help being powerful as a country, but what is the basis for our believing and acting that we are more benevolent or moral than everyone else?
Well, look, I want to make this something clear. All right, you take out, radio people can't see this, but you take out an American dollar bill, all right, there's this Masonic symbol on the back of it. It's the Great Pyramid with the all-seeing eye, and underneath it says, Novo Ordo Seclorum, New Order of the Ages. This is something that comes from the late 1800s. It is a view that a lot of Americans, right from the founding of our republic, held, that the United States is this shining city on the hill. It is a republic that was born in virtue. The term Old Europe was actually not coined by Don Rumsfeld. It was something very current among the founding fathers, who thought that Europe was born in a kind of cynical, you know, realpolitik, and that the American republic was going to be very different because it was democratic. And this is a theme that runs through Woodrow Wilson and, you know, a lot of other prior American statesmen, and is very much embedded in the American conception of itself. Now, are we hypocritical? Do we frequently support dictators? Do we violate human rights ourselves? Is Guantanamo and, you know, Abu Ghraib an atrocity? I mean, I believe the answer to all of those things is yes. But it is also the case that, you know, we have you know, in our self-understanding, believe that we have stood for a different kind of politics or a more democratic kind of politics. And it's been true often enough that I think it's still something that's worth holding on to. Under present circumstances, do I think that we can simply assert our right to superior virtue and benevolence? Absolutely not.
In spite of your renunciation of your support for the neoconservatives' foreign policy agenda, do you still support the neoconservative skepticism about the possibility of ambitious social engineering?
Well, I think that would have been much more sensible if we had approached Iraq with more humility of the sort that would have come out of that tradition that said that it's extremely difficult to engineer these very ambitious kinds of changes in societies.
What, in your view, will be history's judgment of the Bush administration?
Well, look, it's of course it's very hard to say these sorts of things in the middle of the history that's being written. I know that many people will be very satisfied if you say, "Oh, it's going to be a total disaster. He's going to go down as the worst president in American history," you know, so on and so forth. But I just think that we don't really know yet. My own betting is that it is going to be very hard for Iraq. You know, Iraq could actually do better than people are expecting. I think it's going to be very doubtful under almost any scenario that the balance sheet is going to come out positive, that it's going to, you know, it may be better, but will it be worth all of the lives, the resources, the, you know, international position that we sacrificed, you know, to have the war? I really doubt that that's going to look terribly good. But, you know, strange reversals have happened in history previously, so I think we actually ought to leave that historical judgment to historians that will come after us.
Unfortunately, we've reached the point in our program where there is time for only one last question, and I guess the question we'll ask leave you with is, what has been the reaction of the Bush administration to your latest book? Are you still welcome in the White House?
I doubt it. I mean, I am told that there's all sorts of, I mean, that they've got all sorts of bloggers going, trying to shoot me down. So I suspect I'm not going to get any cabinet appointments in the remaining 3 years of the Bush administration.
Our thanks to Dr. Francis Fukuyama, professor of political economy at Johns Hopkins University and author of America at the Crossroads, Democracy, Power, and the Neoconservative Legacy, for his comments this evening. We also thank our audiences here and on the radio. I'm Bob Saldick, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating more than a century of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.